Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we are back on another episode of the Chase Thomas podcast. I am still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, and I am joined, as I am every Thursday on this very program, it's Mr. John Taylor of Fangraphs.com. John, good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Not too bad, not too bad. As I said that before we started recording, I don't know if you can hear, the Khaleesi the dog is literally hitting me in the chest right now trying to record. This is great. She's just really excited about the Braves because, John, the Braves went up 1-0 last night. One of the cooler things about these playoff baseball games is that... oh my goodness. Khaleesi, you're not a part of the show. Khaleesi's not a part of the show. Maybe she knows Fisher's around. But what do you make of the Braves taking game one in last night to Fair, sir?
Well, you always want to win game one if you can.
That's definitely true. Pretty good record.
The hard-hitting analysis here. Certainly, especially with what happened with Charlie Morton, which I imagine we'll get to more specifically, the Braves pretty much had to win game one. They, especially, and on top of that, too, the fact that they are the road team, anytime you can steal a win on the road is always a good thing. You know, you're now in a position where you can, you know, even if you do lose tonight or if you do lose game two, you can still finish the series at home if possible. And if nothing else, the 1-0 advantage means that you are now not in the position of going down 2-0, which is, if not quite a death sentence, and certainly definitely not the place you want to be. So they have that, and they have that advantage going forward for them. The second fact that it was a relatively easy game one, well, I guess easy, like I said, relatively easy. Mm. It was, for all intents and purposes, a blowout for the majority of the game, a five-run lead that went down to 4 runs and stayed there, and, you know, that was never really in doubt except for maybe 1 or 2 different times over the course of the last 5 or 6 innings. So it was relatively stress-free, despite the fact that they lost Morton and despite the fact that they had to use all of their good relievers, including A.J. Minter, for almost 3 full innings. To get it done. But hey, you win the game in front of you, and you worry about the game tomorrow. And at least the Braves are now in that position where they have seemingly less anxiety, I think, than the Astros do. And I think primarily because for the Astros, game one was their best starter on the mound at home. And certainly, you know, they had to face Atlanta's best starter too, but that was their best pitching matchup, I think. Depending how you feel going forward about Jose Urquidy and Luis Garcia and whatever it is they do in game four. But that was definitely the pitcher the Braves had to beat, so to speak, because the road from here, from games 2 through 4, is going to be a lot easier, theoretically, at least pitching-wise, than it was in game one, although they really beat the crap out of Framber Valdez. And that's important, too, is that, you know, Valdez does come back. People pointed out before the game, and it's worth noting, that was not a good matchup for Houston, both in terms of having a left-handed starter against a lot of right-handed power hitters and having a guy who succeeds by getting ground balls against a team that never, ever hits them. So already a bad matchup in the first place, certainly not a good start for Valdez, who pitched pretty terribly And now the open question is, you know, for Houston, okay, our number one guy, our default number one guy, really didn't do the job. And for as much as we know what he's capable of doing and how quickly that switch can be flipped, as you saw in the ALCS, it's no guarantee that the next time Valdez comes out, he's going to do any better. And again, this is a lineup that seems particularly well-suited to hitting him. Now the concern for them has to be, what do we do over the next three games just to get back to a point where we can use Framber Valdez again? So, yeah, very, very big for Atlanta, obviously, to get that series lead. Very big for them to hit hard the best starter they will probably face this entire series. Very good for them to be able to get that win without having to nuke all the best parts of their bullpen. Unlikely we see AJ Minterts in game two, except for an absolute emergency. But, you know, Matzik, Luke Jackson, Will Smith, those guys should be free to contribute at least an inning apiece. So definitely the momentum and the odds in Atlanta's favor. But boy, that Morton injury is not going to be a fun one for them to try to replace.
Yeah, it seems like there's now more initiative, and we'll see tonight because this is going to go up tomorrow. And we'll see how game two ultimately unfolds here with Fried on the mound. But it does seem like the calculus for the Braves has changed, where they need to win this series as fast as humanly possible, where it's like the longer this goes, it now seems more likely that this is in the Astros' favor if this goes to six or seven games, right?
I would agree, if only because, one, you don't have Morton anymore, and for as much as he was only ever going to make one more start in the series, and that would have been Game 5, well, Game 5 would have been his scheduled start. There's a chance, obviously, the Braves could have asked him to start Game 4 on short rest if they were down 2-1, or Game 7 if it were a winner-take-all elimination game, and at the very least, he would have been available, theoretically, as an emergency reliever in those games, and as we all have seen in the past, World Series reliever Charlie Morton is force of nature. So yeah, I would agree. The longer this goes, the worse it is for Atlanta. They were already at a starter. They were already kind of scrambling to get more than three starters for the series. And I don't think Ian Anderson, based on the way he's pitched and the way Brian Snitker has managed him, is going to be a guy who's going to go through the lineup more than twice. So length was going to be important. And at Morton, they had a guy who they clearly felt comfortable letting him go five or six innings a turn, maybe seven if everything turned out all right. Definitely going to have to lean on the bullpen more, and also that is also going to make it that much harder if the series does go long, because especially with that three-game stretch in Atlanta, assuming that they have to play all three games in Atlanta, Bryce Snitker's not going to be able to do things like use AJ Minter to get 6 to 8 outs. He's not going to be able to ask Tyler Matzik for two innings every night. He's probably going to try to ask Tyler Matzik for two innings every night, but regardless. Yes, this is a problem for the Braves if the series goes long. They were already kind of up against it when it came to a fourth starter. I figured that was probably going to be a Kyle Wright, Drew Smyly piggyback experiment, depending on how they wanted to try to force Houston to orient its lineup, if at all, with the lefty versus the righty. Now you're in a position where, you know, when it comes to game four, and obviously there will have to be a game four, assuming Atlanta is not up three games to none and can just kind of do whatever to try to close it out, do you go with Smyly in game four and save Wright for game five? Do you flip that? Do you try to use one of them for game five? Do you use both of them for game four? And bullpen game five, knowing that that's going to be the third game in a row if you do have to play it. I don't know. I'm really glad I'm not Brian Snitker and don't have to figure this out. But yeah, it is a big loss, even if Morton only was going to make one more start. And I totally agree. The longer the series goes, it would seem like the advantage would be Houston's, particularly if the series does go longer. They're going to get multiple looks at these Atlanta relievers. And I think, as we've seen in postseasons past, you know, some of the benefit of being able to go to these relievers as often as possible does get a little mitigated by the fact that batters very clearly get more comfortable and more, or at least theoretically, get more comfortable and more familiar with them the more they see them, and the more, and especially because all relievers are essentially failed starters, which means the great majority of relievers are two-pitch pitchers who do not have a ton of stamina left at this point. So going very bullpen heavy in a seven-game series, you know, the Braves managed to make it work against the Dodgers. But the flip side of that is, look what that did to the Dodgers, who barely even got to game six pitching-wise and then just had nothing left for that one.
Yeah, and I do wonder, because Luke just came back, does that mean with Luke Rising, one of the other relievers starts to implode? But that was great to see, because, I mean, I know I'm not alone in being very nervous, and was very nervous about him entering the game when he did. But what we will not forget, John, is that that slide by Gurriel into second was just phenomenal, top notch.
Yeah, that was rough. He very clearly, one, he thought that ball was gone when he hit it, And so he clearly didn't get out of the box full speed. Two, he only noticed, I think, that ball had stayed in play once he reached first base. You could tell, I don't know if Fox ever showed a replay of him running from home to second, which I would have loved to see. I mean, I think just generally Fox's production for baseball games is really bad, but, you know, regardless. It did look to me like at some point he kind of stopped around first and then realized this ball is still in play. I can turn this into a double and tried to pick it back up. And that's probably what led to his Ian Kinsler-esque face-first slide, where I think he just lost his balance, stumbled a bit, and then just couldn't recover his equilibrium in time. But yeah, the Astros shot themselves in the foot a lot last night. They did not play well. Some of that, I think, was just the Braves just punched them really hard first. And, you know, once you're down 5-0 basically after three innings, it's kind of hard to put up a rally against that. But certainly last night was probably, if I don't think it's the worst, there's really not the worst game the Astros have played this postseason. Games 2 and 3 of the ALCS were far, far worse in terms of their overall play. But yeah, I made a joke to a friend of mine once Valdez came out in the third and once Morton followed, that this is probably not a series that's going to be very aesthetically pleasing. These are two teams that are just kind of scrapping and fighting in that very kind of desperate sense. And this isn't a series like, say, the last time Houston was in the World Series, where we had Garrett Cole against Max Scherzer, Zach Greinke against Steven Strasburg. You know, it wasn't these crazy pitching matchups and anything like that. I think the pitching, especially in this series, is going to be pretty much a battle of attrition. It's who has the last functional pitching staff still standing, because as we saw, I mean, Atlanta's lineup is very good. Houston's lineup is obviously very good. There are not a whole lot of places in either lineup for pitchers kind of to take a break. In particular, Houston's lineup goes 7 deep, which is just terrifying. So, yeah, I think this is necessarily going to be a series where there are a ton of runs scored, but I don't think this is going to be a series where we're going to see a lot of consistent or even really great pitching beyond, I think, the relievers that we see. I think it's, as with every other game this postseason, we're going to see a lot of relievers, and we're going to see, I think, a lot of kind of, I don't foresee the pace for this one being particularly fun. And I know that was, it feels weird complaining about the time of baseball because there's a lot of baked in that can, you know, you can't really change. But boy, last night's game was an absolute slog. And I understand that there were logistical reasons for that. I understand that anytime you have a game where both starters both leave in the third inning, you know, the pace is not going to improve from there because you're just going to have to use your bullpen a lot. But boy, that game just dragged. And I am a little worried that in a series where there really aren't consistent starters left, this one, I think Morton is probably the most consistent, or at least the most dependable and durable guy left. You know, it's unlikely we're going to be seeing too many great pitching performances, at least from starters in this series, I think.
Yeah. Well, put on your clairvoyant hat, John. What happened tonight for the folks who are listening to this on Thursday morning on their commute in? What happened tonight?
I think the Astros win. I have a hard time seeing them go down 0-2. Obviously, the big issue here is going to be how many outs can they get from Jose Urquidy before they have to turn to the bullpen. If there's good news for Houston last night, it's that they didn't really have to use any of the good parts of their bullpen, or at least the parts that they wanted to save, a.k.a. Ryan Pressly and Kendall Graveman in particular, both of whom should be available to get, I imagine, anywhere from 6 to 9 outs between at least 6 to 9 outs between the two of them. So as long as Urquidy can get through the lineup twice in decent shape, I think Houston will be in good shape too. The obvious X factor there is Fried, who has been terrific, with the exception of his start against the Dodgers. What was up with that? I can't say for sure. You know, I haven't followed him enough or watched him enough pitch to know if that was just a bad outing or, you know, something to be concerned about. The interesting thing I'll be looking to see, and this is something that I found kind of curious about the way Snitker has handled Fried, is he really hasn't let him go long. I think 5-6 innings is about the max he's really been comfortable with, despite the fact that, you know, especially now at this point, this is definitely a series where if you can somehow get 6 to 7 full innings out of Fried and, you know, 6 to 7 good innings, that's a huge, huge advantage to give that bullpen that much rest, coupled with the off day heading into Game 3. But I can see Snitker being cautious with Fried, though, especially against the lineup that is, one, this good, and two, has this many good right-handed power hitters. I imagine that Fried will probably be done after 5 maximum. So it really is, again, going to rest on, you know, how much can Atlanta get out of that Matzik And again, I have to imagine Minter's not available tonight. So it'll depend on how much good they can get out of Matzik, Jackson, and Smith, and conversely, how much good Houston can get out of not just Presley and Graveman, but I imagine Christian Javier is also going to play a really big role in game two, because if Urquidy can't get through the lineup a second time, I imagine Javier is probably going to be asked to do what Jake Odorizzi did last night, in game one rather, and get at least two or three innings of relief so that, you know, the bullpen doesn't have to burn itself to the ground, especially considering that, you know, game four is almost certainly going to be a bullpen game, even if Zach Greinke is the nominal starter, because I just don't see him at this stage in his career. He doesn't seem like someone who's really good to do a lineup more than once at this point.
John, I've got some bad news. Bing bong, you're wrong. The Braves went up 2-0. Sorry. I hate to inform you, but the Braves went up 2-0 last night.
Okay, what is this bing bong thing?
Have you not watched the Knicks fan video?
No, I don't. Are you talking about the one from opening night?
Yes, where they are all, like,
okay,
all these different fans.
Yeah, I have, for some reason, forgotten about the bing bong thing. I've seen people tweeting about it.
It cracks me up every time I see it.
I ignore Knicks fans online for the most part because they're lab rats on cocaine. They're being fed stimuli that they don't understand and can't control.
Mm.
And so they're just letting the base impulse fly out despite the fact that they have no control over any part of the situation. And I'm not saying that in a way to be like, oh, stupid Knicks fans, don't be happy. No, fine, Knicks fans be happy. I just find the degree to which Knicks fans celebrate to be just... It is like someone injected them with pharmaceutical cocaine. Like, they beat the Sixers last night, and I was genuinely worried a small chunk of Midtown was going to be burned down after game, like, 5 or whatever of the season.
It just means more.
I mean, I know this is not your NBA podcast episode, but yeah, Knicks fans, number one, Knicks fans are just permanently on one. Number two, I am already looking forward to the 1997 or whatever Redux that will be a Bulls-Knicks Eastern Conference Finals, where every game is legally mandated to end with a final score where neither team breaks 90 points, and where Spike Lee spends the entire time just groaning in his seat while like, I don't know, they got to bring like Pat Riley back for it somehow. I know he was never a Knicks or Bulls head coach, but they got to bring him there just to taunt Spike, I think. Either way, I'm a little afield for my expertise here. You can probably tell.
Hey, there it is. Something that's in your expertise, John. The San Francisco Giants and what they do with the potential Marcus Semien deal, because that's the rumor. He wants to go back to the West Coast. Man, this is tough because the Blue Jays have done everything right. I think they're just, if he's back and they just add a few more starting pitching, if they are ready to go in 2023 when there's a season again, that they're right there. The Blue Jays are close, and this would just be such a devastating blow because I don't know who they could actually add that would replace him. It's kind of like when the Jazz were faced with this thing with Mike Conley, where it's like, yeah, if Mike Conley leaves, like, there's no one else in the market that you can use, so you have to give him this money even if you don't think he's worth this because you can't find anybody even close. So it's just complicated. But Semien just being as good as he was for Toronto this year feels very Kawhi-like, right? When he, like, they did everything right in Canada. They won a title. They didn't win a title with Toronto yet, but, you know, he's been great, and they have this awesome young core, great front office. They're doing everything right. Baseball's back in Toronto, great fan base, but the dude doesn't want to live in Canada, in Toronto. So then what do you do here with him still being in the prime of his career? And if he wants to go back to California, then what really can you do? How do you think this ends? And do you think Blue Jays fans should be nervous?
I mean, nervous, sure, because like you said, Semien prefers the West Coast. It's, you know, it's where his professional career pretty much started. I know he's with Chicago before Oakland, but he never really played for Chicago. And there's also the fact that, you know, I'm assuming that the Blue Jays stick with Bo Bichette at shortstop and that they don't
die. He was also born in San Francisco, we should say.
Okay, so that makes it even more the case. So, and assuming, as I was saying, assuming that the Blue Jays stick with Bo Bichette at shortstop and continue trying Kevin Biggio at third base, although that's obviously an open question as to what they want to do there, the market for second baseman is not great. Semien is a shortstop, and I assume that he will market himself as a shortstop. And there are guys on the list of available shortstops, in particular Javi Baez, who you can very easily, you know, plug in at second base and go with it. But if you're looking for guys who are primarily second baseman, the next best name in the free agent market after Semien, or at least the guys you would play at second base, is Jurickson Profar. And he really is more of a utility guy at this point. Similarly with Chris Taylor, who certainly can handle second base, but I don't think is someone you want playing regularly at second base. And the truth is, most of Chris Taylor's value comes not from just sticking him at second base for 162 games, but for the fact he can play second or third or the outfield. And, you know, he's basically basically the same function that Kike Hernandez plays for the Red Sox and used to play for the Dodgers. So I think they're, you know, if you're the, especially if you're the Blue Jays, given too that you traded away Austin Martin in order to get Jose Berríos, and you now have that much less middle infield depth in your system, yeah, it'd be a tough loss for them to lose Semien. And I'm not sure what they would do, because they also have a lot of other questions they need to figure out payroll-wise. They need to figure out if they want to bring back Robbie Ray. They presume they probably should add a starter beyond that. There is other work they need to do. They could consider exploring potential long-term extensions for, at the very least, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., maybe, you know, put the feelers out with Teoscar Hernandez's camp, with Bichette's camp, with all the other, excuse me, good young hitters that they have. So, yeah, I think it would be obviously very tough for Toronto to replace him, and not just, you know, replace him in the field, but also atop the lineup. You know, they don't really have, I think, a guy who fits in neatly up there. Semien was far and away their best on-base guy. The other flip side of that is he would make perfect sense for the Giants. I know they have Marco Luciano coming up through the system as their shortstop of the future, and that they still have Brandon Crawford there in place. But Semien, I think, would be a very good option at second base for them, where, you know, they got good work out of Donovan Solano and a few other guys, but Semien is obviously a and Donovan Solano and Tommy La Stella, but Semien obviously makes that a little easier. He is a plug-and-play guy that you never have to worry about. He is your full-time starter at second base. He can handle shortstop if Crawford goes down or is struggling. You know, I think that makes a lot of sense for them, especially because they, I think, you know, and not having fully digested what their payroll looks like for next year, really haven't thought, not having thought all that much about kind of what the Giants are going to or want to look like next year. They seem like a team that probably does not have that much they need to do this offseason, given that they're coming off 106 wins and have a roster that's pretty strong. I think, you know, the difference for the Giants next year is going to be whether or not the old guys keep performing. I don't think it's going
to... Well, that's what I was going to say, is I think that they actually might have a lot of work to do to ensure that this does keep going. I don't think they should sit on their laurels whatsoever.
Oh, no, and I agree with that. They shouldn't, but better said, I think the other issue, too, is where are they... It's kind of like, do they have the roster flexibility to make that work? You know, they're not going to go out and... There aren't any good options anyway, but they're not going to go out and get a new catcher. You know, they're not going to go out and get a new shortstop. They're probably not going to go out and look at the third base market. Instead, you know, live with Evan Longoria. I mean, the big question, I suppose, is whether or not they want to do something at first base now that Brandon Belt is a free agent, whether or not they want to bring him back, whether or not they want to go with someone younger, whether or not they want to make a trade there. That is obviously TBD, but at the very least, I think San Francisco has more stability on the roster overall than Toronto does, and I think has a somewhat higher locked-in floor. I do think, obviously, Semien would go a long way to improving that and improving the ceiling for that team, which is also going to be hugely important for them because, like you said, you know, you don't want to rest on your laurel, especially when the competition in your division is the Dodgers and a Padres team that definitely should be better. Or at the very least, if they are healthier, should be better next year. So I think it would be a really smart move for San Francisco. I think it's a tough choice for Toronto as to who or what you want to prioritize. I would imagine that Semien is probably high up on the list because, like I said, there aren't too many great external options for second base. And given the way Biggio played this season, I don't know how comfortable the Blue Jays feel just giving him one of second or third and saying, well, that'll work itself out. So we shall see, but assuming he doesn't go back to Toronto, I think, yeah, San Francisco makes a ton of sense for Semien.
Ozzie Guillen interviewed for the San Diego Padres managerial position. Do you want to see Ozzie managing the Padres, and would it make sense to you?
Does it make sense? Absolutely not. Ozzie's crazy. Like, whatever benefit he brings in terms of clubhouse, whatever, or getting along with the Latin players or tactical experts, whatever, he's crazy. He is crazy. He is a loudmouth. He does not know when to shut up. He does not know when not to speak. He does not. He doesn't. And at the same time, he doesn't. It's not even that he doesn't know. He clearly doesn't care. He doesn't care one bit. He has his opinion, and you're going to hear his opinion. And I generally don't think that a team otherwise that otherwise doesn't really court any kind of controversy, with the exception of whenever someone gets mad about Fernando Tatis being cool, really should be trying to court that. You know, the problem with the Padres was not that their manager was too timid or not enough of a blustery guy. I mean, Jace Tingler was certainly not a red-faced screamer type, but I don't get the sense that the solution there is let's hand the team over to an abject lunatic.
Mm.
You know, the vibe I've always gotten from San Diego is let's hand this team over to someone who knows what they're doing, specifically and particularly someone who has tactical experience, just simple managerial tactical experience that Jace Tingler never had. And I understand that there's probably a desire to want someone who maybe like an Alex Cora mode or mold, who has an energy and also can connect to guys and is recently retired, so they're, you know, they remember what life is like in the clubhouse. But that Ozzie Guillen doesn't really fit any of that, and you'd have to talk to White Sox fans to get a better sense of what he's like tactically, but I never got the sense Ozzie was a particularly great manager. I got the sense he was more just a loudmouth who just had a lot of energy, and I struggle to see how that's not just a solution for the Padres right now, but also a long-term solution. Ozzie seems explicitly like the kind of guy who lasts two or three seasons before everyone gets so completely sick of his shit and or he says or does something like indescribably stupid that he's not tenable anymore. What the Padres need is reliable, I think, veteran steadiness. And Ozzie Guillen's definitely a veteran manager, but I mean, it's also the fact he hasn't managed in the majors since the Marlins let him go about 10 years ago. This is not a guy who's particularly plugged in with the current major league scene, and he never seemed particularly plugged in with the advancing white wave of analytics at the time either. You know, I think if anything, like, and I imagine, you know, regardless of what happens in the series, but particularly if they win it, if the Astros decide to let Dusty Baker walk, I can't think of a more perfect match than him just going over to San Diego and bringing his laid-back vibes and just endless wealth of baseball knowledge to a team that really seemed like what it needed more than anything was a steady, like, stabilizing veteran influence who also could just, you know, you didn't really second guess as much, you know. And I think that was something with Tingler where, you know, I can't speak to what he was like in the clubhouse, and you know, only the Padres themselves really know what that was like, but he never particularly struck me as someone who had it didn't seem like he had that firm a grasp on the tactics or the decision making. And I think, you know, for as much as you can say, oh, Dusty's too old to be around these young, I mean, he's worked great with Houston, but I think he also makes sense for a team that does have veterans and that does just need, I think, that veteran managerial leadership and someone who just, you know, is not going to panic when things go wrong, is not going to, you know, not that Tingler did, but again, the steady hand at the tiller, I think, is what the Padres need. And Ozzie Guillen is just going to yank that thing all over the place and send them on a... Yeah, maybe he leads that team to 90 wins, but I think way more likely is he leads them to like 75 wins and he gets fired by the end of the season because he just says something just egregiously awful in the process. So, no, I don't think he makes sense. I have to imagine that the Padres are either doing someone a favor or just checking all the requisite boxes. I would be shocked if Ozzie Guillen ever manages in the big leagues again.
Okay. Fair enough. King Griffey Jr., in happier news, gets an ownership stake in the Seattle Mariners, John.
Cool, good for Griffey. I like when teams do this. I like when longtime players come back and are like, I'm here to, you know, to ostensibly to make sure that this team keeps doing good things, mm-hmm. but in reality, just so I can basically hang around the ballpark and get paid to do it. Which, hey,
it's not a bad gig.
Dream job. Yeah, if you can get that work, by all means, go get it. So, you know, good for Griffey. Good for the Mariners, I suppose. I don't imagine he will have that much of a say in whatever is going on. I mean, that's kind of the thing, though, is we've never really gotten an inkling before that Griffey was either A, all that interested in being an owner. I mean, maybe he said something in recent years and I've just totally missed it, but you never really got that sense that he was, you know, desperate to become part of the plutocrat class.
Mm.
And B, there was never any, I don't feel like, any indication that Griffey was one of those, you know, I have a lot of ideas for how baseball should be, guys. I mean, maybe he does, and he just hasn't shared them. He's certainly a public-facing individual, but he's not a guy who's, like, you know, out in the limelight all the time. I think he values his privacy when he can get it. I mean, literally Ken Griffey Jr. But, you know, it is just interesting to see that because, you know, maybe Mariners fans could speak obviously a little better to this, but Yeah, I guess I'm curious, like, what Griffey brings to the table for the Mariners beyond just a familiar smiling face and a reliable presence at, you know, events at the stadium or anniversaries, just to, you know, a nice thing to, for Mariners fans to remember, be like, hey, here's Ken Griffey Jr. Don't you remember how much you love him? And everyone goes, yeah, of course we love Ken Griffey Jr. That makes what the Mariners do that much more palatable. The cynic in me wants to think that they're just going to throw him out there to report all the bad things. Like, oh yeah, we didn't actually make any trades this deadline. But if nothing else, given how bad the rest of Seattle's ownership seems to be at the whole talking to the press and fans and not saying things that they shouldn't say and or behaving like enormous jackasses, Griffey is probably a big step forward in that. In someone, I think more than anything, it's someone that Seattle can put out as the more public face of ownership, who is not Glenn Mather or a Glenn Mather type flunky, and feel at least better about that, you know, hey, here's someone you all love, as opposed to an executive who won't shut the hell up about screwing with service time. Let's focus on Ken Griffey Jr. So I'll take the cynical route there, but it is nice, I think, to see. It's always nice when a fan favorite comes back to a franchise and becomes a part of it. So that's a nice thing, I think, for the Mariners and Ken Griffey Jr.
All right. Well, John Taylor, the last thing we have to touch on here. Happier news with your Boston Red Sox just missed the World Series. We almost had two worlds colliding on this very program, John. We almost had the Red Sox versus the Braves, a house divided, a podcast divided, if you will.
Yes.
But no, we got the Astros.
We almost had to make a really stupid regional bet.
Mm. If the Braves had beaten the Red Sox in a World Series, I think I would have bet you that you have to eat Waffle House every day for 2 weeks straight.
Okay, I would pray that the Red Sox lose. That's awesome. Also,
you say that now. I love Waffle House.
There's no Waffle House anywhere near me is the other problem.
Mm. Is there not? We need to expand it to New York.
New York's a little far north of the Mason-Dixon. So.
Okay, well, everyone loves Waffle House. Anthony Bourdain loves Waffle House.
Yes, I also love Waffle House. This would have been a great bet for me. Any bet?
What is your order at Waffle House?
I haven't been in a while. Last time I went was in Tampa, like, 4 years ago.
Okay.
I think I just got the basic, like, waffle, scrambled eggs, hash browns, you know, toast. Just the regular, just give me what you got. Like,
give me what you got, he said. He's like, just give me what you've got back there, John Taylor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Give me what you got on the griddle. I can see you doing stuff. That's the thing. I don't know Waffle House enough to have like a Waffle House order, but times I've been to Waffle House, yeah, then just have ordered the basics, I've been very happy with what showed up. So would this have been also every meal at Waffle House, or just once a day for 2 weeks?
I can't be responsible for you becoming a type 2 diabetic within 2 weeks.
I was going to say, like, that's a bet that I would still take because it's still delicious, but it ends with me in the ICU.
Do you remember during the sandwich wars, that kid who ate, like, a bunch of, was it Popeye sandwiches? He ate, like, just nonstop Popeye's chicken sandwiches and then wound up in the ICU.
Well, now I want a Popeye's chicken sandwich, so I hope you're happy.
Well, I've actually never had a Popeye's chicken sandwich.
Okay, but you live in Chick-fil-A land, so...
What's wrong with Chick-fil-A land? Have you
had... I'm just saying, it's got to be... Of course I've had Chick-fil-A. I'm just saying, it's got to be a little different for y'all, because you got Chick-fil-A.
Did you just say y'all? Look at you. You pod with somebody for a couple years, and then the Southern dialect comes out a little bit.
I grew up in Western Maryland. I grew up in...
We're not considering... Maryland's not the South. No, we're not doing this.
It's basically Kentucky, but you know
what? No, it's not. What? Basically Kentucky.
Kentucky is holler as hell. Kentucky is this weird combo of the South and the, like, rural Midwest.
Mm.
It's a weird, at least as far as I can tell from going to Louisville and driving through Kentucky, it just, that's the vibe it gives off, is the South, but also Western Pennsylvania.
It's the South adjacent. Like, it's not fully South.
It's the South, but with a little too much Ohio.
Yes. Very close to Ohio, though.
Yeah, in fact, they touch. Cincinnati and Louisville are about an hour and a half apart.
Weirdly enough, though, Lexington is closer to me than Atlanta.
Huh.
3 hours.
Lexington has that decidedly southern feel because of the horse racing, though, I think.
Mm. Never seen a horse race.
That is a sport I associate it so closely with the South
that,
to me, that part... I think Louisville has a different vibe. I know, obviously, they have the the Kentucky Derby in Louisville, not in Lexington, but Louisville, I mean, when I was there, just the vibe it gave me was way more like Ohio, Western Pennsylvania than it was anywhere in the South that I've been. Which, granted, the South is probably the, along with the Mountain West, if we want to call it that, the region of the U.S. I have the least amount of time, I believe, I've spent in, so.
Hmm. Well.
Especially the Deep South. I have not done the Deep South with the exception of a few trips to Hartsfield Jackson.
Noted Deep South, Hartsfield Jackson.
Noted, what is it, a Delta hub? Which one is it?
It, I mean, Delta, yeah. Delta is in Atlanta. But I've always been a Southwest guy. I'm weirdly loyal to Southwest. My dad got me on that a long time ago. Just an ugly plane, though. The solid blue.
It's just the ugly colors. But what I was going to say is, I think, obviously, for you guys, like, for us up here in the North, like, a great chicken sandwich, we don't get that much. It really was just Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
And I guess if you felt like doing one of the kind of major fast food chicken sandwiches, but then, you know, the Popeyes.
No Zaxby's.
And no Zaxby's, no Raising Cane, no Bojangles, you know, no nothing where chicken is really on the menu as a regular thing. It really, up here, is just Popeyes and KFC. Mm. And, you know, stuff like, regional stuff like Church's, which, you know, they do fried chicken, but it's, you know, again, it ain't Zaxby's. And it certainly ain't the fried chicken places you can find in, like, Georgia or, you know, Tennessee or anywhere else.
I mean, the food, the barbecue, all of it. Like, the South does food better than anybody else in the country, that's for sure.
Yes, we narrowly missed out on a World Series where I would have forced you to eat clam chowder. That's right.
I've never eaten clam chowder.
Clam chowder in Knoxville.
That sounds like I'm gonna get sick.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust it. Like, you're way too far inland for clam chowder to be something that you should feel comfortable about.
Where was I recently where they had, like, just some kind of fish out? And I was like, this isn't, like, the Sports Renaissance woman mentioned to me. She was like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, no. What? Knoxville fish? What? No.
I don't know. Like, a fried whitefish. I can live with that.
I'm very dubious of fish, John. I don't know.
That's fair.
I'm very nervous about fish. I had an old roommate who used to grill it all the time on, like, the stovetop, and I was just flabbergasted, where I'm like, do you really trust yourself enough to cook your own fish? Can't do it. No, don't trust myself. But, John, the reason I brought all of that up, and the folks now know where we stand in all the local chicken restaurants in the South, your Red Sox have some difficult decisions with Rafael Devers and Xander Bogaerts. Is your expectation that both are with this organization this time next year?
Yes, because I don't... For one, Bogaerts is already signed long-term, so unless the Red Sox have decided that they don't like the terms of whatever is left on that contract, which, after the season Bogaerts has, would make no sense, I don't really see any reason for them to move him unless they are... I think the only reason either would move is if the Red Sox are convinced that they have a real shot at one of the Carlos Correa, Trevor Story, Corey Seager groups of shortstops, like literally that top tier. And I think, you know, the next tier down, I think, would start with Javi Baez, because I don't think he can be trusted offensively. But regardless, I think that's the only way that would make sense. And with the idea being you would sign someone like Correa, move Bogaerts to third, and then either put Devers at first base, or maybe you dangle one of the two of them to try to get, I'm not even sure what. I guess that's kind of thing. It's hard to imagine exactly. I mean, I imagine either would bring back a very good amount of anything, although Bogaerts probably less so, because, you know, even though he does have the cost control of the extension, it's not a small one. So, and it's also something where given that he is in his late 20s now, or mid to late 20s, more likely not only real contenders are going to be in on that. You know, does that make, would he make sense as an option for teams that do miss out on the Correa Seager Story group? Maybe, you know, maybe the Red Sox can see what interest does exist there. I think the problem is if you move either one of those guys, what are you doing to replace them? The only thing that makes sense to me is if you move one of them, it's because you're signing one of Correa, Story, or Seager and making yourself better defensively at least one spot, and probably two, depending if Bogaerts moves to third. I mean, in an ideal world, you sign Correa, move Bogaerts to third, and Devers to first, and that's the end of that. But I don't think the Red Sox are going to do that. I don't think they have the appetite for the money that any of those top three guys are going to command. I don't think they have the appetite for moving yet another fan favorite young player so soon after the Mookie Betts deal. And I especially think they're not going to have the desire to do that after both of them had very good seasons offensively. To me, there's really no reason to move Bogaerts or Devers unless you think you can improve the situation somehow. And I think it's a really narrow path doing that. And it also relies on the Red Sox suddenly deciding they want to spend again, which I kind of have a hard time seeing that happen. So I think they both stick around long term. I think they both stick around for at least 2022. Long term, I'm curious. In particular, it's going to depend a lot on how Devers' defense either improves or stagnates at third base. And also, it will, to a certain degree, depend on Tristan Casas, the Red Sox top first base prospect, and what he can do, because obviously if something happens to him or if he stalls out, the chances of Devers moving to first base and becoming the full-time first baseman go up significantly, particularly if the team just feels like his defense at third is never going to be stable enough for them to trust him there. But I think that's a decision you don't have to make right now, and I certainly don't see, you know, after the seasons the two of them had, Boston deciding to make themselves weaker again, unless they're going to add someone like Correa or Seager's story. And even then, I'm not 100% sure that kind of move is worth it unless you know you can get something really good in return for either Bogaerts or Devers. So I just feel like there would be too many moving pieces and too many what-ifs and theoretical realities for that kind of move to make sense.
Okay. I have some breaking news as we wrap up tonight, John.
It better not be about chicken sandwiches.
No. Okay. But I think I'm absolutely getting chicken sandwiches after we're done here. I think that's my pre-Braves game meal. So the Padres have finalized the hiring, not of their new manager, their new pitching coach, Ruben Yelba.
Formerly of the Indians, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so I know I've seen a few people on Twitter who are very
this
much
is huge.
Into the pitching and yeah, very much into the pitching and pitch design stuff. We've talked about him as a rising star in those ranks. The assistant pitching coach in Cleveland, where they have obviously done fantastic work with a ton of different pitchers. Interesting to me, one of those guys is Cal Quantrill, who the Padres had and traded in the Mike Clevenger deal, and then ended up being a pretty good mid-rotation guy for Cleveland that the Padres desperately could have used last season. So I'm not surprised, especially given the way that pitching development seems to have kind of gone a little haywire in San Diego in the last couple of years, that they want a guy who's got a track record of being part of a great pitching an organization that does great pitching development. So not surprised that that's the direction the Padres went. Be very interesting now to see what manager comes on with that, because if you're going to hire a guy like that coming out of a very advanced, very kind of, I you know, it feels like a safe assumption with Cleveland pitching, with a very kind of forward-looking, analytics-driven, you know, all the good things, you know, a very forward-looking pitching group, that you're going to want a manager who's going to be of a similar mindset. You know, I do wonder if that takes him out of the running for a more veteran guy who would almost certainly want to bring in his own coaches. And I think that's kind of the other interesting thing about this too, is you hire a pitching coach before a manager. I think it's similar to, you know, kind of similar to what the Yankees did in keeping Aaron Boone, but basically getting rid of the entirety of the staff minus Matt Blake. I think that makes it very clear that this is obviously it is a front office managed search, but that this is a search for a managerial, both a manager and a coaching staff that will listen to the front office and that can work with the front office. And it basically is the front office, but just in coaching form. Because I think you saw it, you know, I brought Blake up, also a product of the Cleveland organization in terms of pitching development. I think that probably is the way forward for those guys. The pitching is less about kind of the crusty old coach and more about the guys who have experience developing younger guys, because I think that's just the way pitching works now, is you have so many young guys who kind of need that development. And also not just starters too, but relievers and the sheer staggering amount of data that most teams now produce, I think it makes sense to have a guy too who has experience with that, has that in his background. Again, the question now just becomes, if you are hiring a pitching coach before you hire a manager, what does that say about, one, who you want to hire as a manager, and two, how much autonomy that manager is going to have over both big and small decisions and over the day-to-day stuff? But that's obviously a question we can tackle a little more in depth when the Padres actually do decide to hire a manager, whenever that is.
Whenever that is.
It has to happen at some point, unless mm-hmm. Ron Fowler has decided he wants to manage the team himself, a la Ted Turner.
Yeah.
Please know I would pay a substantial substantial amount of money to watch Ron Fowler try to manage a major league team. It would be extremely funny, pretty much along the likes of what happened when Ted Turner tried to do it, and the league had to step in and say, are you out of your mind? Fuck no. Go away. But yes, very, very interested to see what comes out of San Diego's search.
There you go. There you go. John, we can follow you on Twitter at J.A. Taylor. Go subscribe to Fangraphs.com today if you have not already done so. Become a member. It's great. Great work over there at Fangraphs.com. So go do that and keep up with all their great shows and writing and all that good stuff. But John, thank you as always, my friend. I will talk to you next week.
All right.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.